tendency to impose accuracy has shifted, and it's partly been the result of technology, I guess, and cost pressures that have shifted the industry into the use of technology more than anything else. Because when I started off in newspapers, any word that appeared in the paper would have had to have been checked by something like six or eight times, from the reporter himself, through the sub-editor, news editor, printer who would set the type, compositor who'd put it onto the page. And the compositors were, if they saw something wrong, they had no hesitation in telling you. And then it would go back up to have a proof checked, and then the proof would not only be checked by the sub-editor, would go back to a pair of readers who would read it to make sure, absolutely sure, that everything was spot on. These days, a reporter will write a story, effectively sub-edit it themselves, and put it in as a package, which gets a brief amount of subbing and then goes into the computer and turns into print. And of course, too many people use the word checker rather than read it, so it now becomes not. And the spell checker still thinks it's right. With that drift away from an obsession with accuracy, my feeling is that the whole media, television and newspapers, have allowed a lot more personal bias to creep into reports, and I think that's been unfortunate. I think it's what it's tended to do, apart from anything else, is shift a lot of the emphasis away from reporting the merits or demerits of legislation or political activities into trivia and opinions. So, however, times change.
That's right, yeah. With the sale of the Daily Telegraph, did things actually change in the way the paper was run under Murdoch? Or was it pretty much business as usual for you?
No, it stayed pretty much for the first 12 months at least, possibly longer. They retained the same editor. Alan Reid didn't come with the paper. Alan stayed with Consolidated Press, Frank Packer. And television was just embryonic in those days, but it was getting bigger. So Alan sort of shifted from being a print journalist to a TV personality. Richard Farmer came in as the political correspondent for the Telegraph, but that was really about the only fundamental change that was made in the lineup. So the Telegraph, it certainly, well, certainly it became far less a vehicle that strongly supported the Liberal Party to one that was either neutral or pro-Labor. It was probably more anti-Liberal than aggressively pro-Labor, I'd say. But that was about the only significant change. Gradually, King Watson had been the editor for many, many years. King was then sent to London as the he was sent to London to do something. I'm just trying to think what. But in any event, they then changed editors, and the paper became a little bit more tabloid. Or it was a tabloid. It became a little bit more like an afternoon tabloid than a morning one. But there were no dramatic changes in it. I think Rupert would not have been comfortable with the rather conservative layout of the old Daily Telegraph. No doubt was making changes to it, but there was nothing that I saw that really stuck in my mind. until, of course, the later days when they merged the Telegraph and Mirror, and then there were some quite dramatic changes. But that was some time in the future, yeah.
And eventually, I mean, 1975, you work for Reg Ruthers, become a press secretary, a staffer. I'm wondering, how did you feel in that period? I should ask, what led to you deciding to become a staffer rather than remain in the editing and journalism field?
Well, there are a couple of things. I'd shifted. When the Telegraph, I was the deputy bureau chief of the Telegraph. When Packer sold it, I then became the deputy bureau chief of the News Limited Canberra bureau, which caused a little bit of angst among some of the former News Limited staff, who I effectively went over the top of. I then got moved to the Australian as basically a political features writer, and in December of 1974, by that time you could see that the Labor government was falling apart. It was having all sorts of difficulties, there'd been the Snedden experience and the double dissolution had taken place, which the Libs lost and Labor just got back. And then in December 75, Whitlam decided to go on a six or seven week trip around the world. And I was rewarded by being given that assignment to travel with him for 6-7 weeks. It was one of Gough's biggest mistakes, I think, because he managed to alienate a lot of people in the gallery, even those journalists who were pro-Labor were becoming disillusioned, and they became irritated about the idea of having to go away at Christmas time when everyone just wanted to have a holiday, I think. And this was not a holiday. We went to... it's a long story, but it's sort of quite explainable. So we go to Europe, and something funny was going on. I couldn't get my handle on it, but Len Hewitt was then head of... I think Len was still head of Prime Minister and Cabinet. He may have moved to Minerals and Energy, I'm not sure. But in any event, Len Hewitt came with us, and Len disappeared for a little while in England. So there was something funny going on. And then, of course, Cyclone Tracy hit Darwin, and Gough flew back on a commercial flight, which annoyed everyone because they did it in the dead of night and didn't tell anyone that he was going. So that was a minor thing, but it was still... On trips overseas with the Prime Minister, very minor issues tend to become blown out of all proportion. They just set off a niggly feeling among the travelling press, and that compounds itself. Anyway, Gough then let us travel along with... I'm not sure, I think this was after he came back. We went to Italy and we were running late in... the plane landed at Rome's airport late, and Gough was met by his usual motorcade. But the appointment he had with the Rome Prime Minister had been cancelled for the afternoon, so he had the afternoon off. So we're in the motorcade, and for some reason I hitched a ride with the police car that was travelling behind Whitlam's car, and the other journos were on a bus. And so the motorcade goes through past the Colosseum, past something else, and then all of a sudden the prime ministerial vehicle in front turned right. And the rest of the motorcade kept on going. And of course, we were in the escort car behind the prime minister, so we turned right to follow him. And we ended up, what happened is Gofford said, "Oh, Margaret, we've got the afternoon off. Let's go and see the Vatican." So they went to the Vatican. And of course, there were only the two Commonwealth police and me. So one of them said to me, "Okay," he said, "hold your right hand up and solemnly swear that I swear to uphold the laws and something or other of Australia." Blah, blah, blah. So I was sworn in as a acting constable of the Australian Federal Police, or Commonwealth Police. And my job was to go with the other two and make sure that the Prime Minister was protected as he walked through the Vatican. And we did have to, too, because there were all these Australian tourists there, most of whom were giving Gough a bit of a razz. So he'd become a little bit unpopular even then. We travelled, we went to Russia, and I vividly recall coming out of our hotel one day and seeing a lot of old women literally in rags, sweeping the ice off the, or shoveling the ice off the footpath. And walking around them were all these much younger women in fur coats, obviously the wives, daughters, or relatives of the apparatchik. And I just suddenly thought, well, if this is what communism is all about, I don't like it. Then we went to Amsterdam, not Amsterdam, The Hague. And that morning the news came through that the freighter had run into the Hobart Bridge, the Tasman Bridge in Hobart. And so I got a phone call from the office saying, "What does the Prime Minister think about that?" So in we go to the press conference, and I said, "Prime Minister, I walked up to him first. I said, "Look, I'm going to have to ask you a question. I don't know whether you've heard about it yet or not, but the freighter's run into the Tasman Bridge and sunk it." And he said, "Snyder, only you would enjoy telling me something like that." So we got to the press conference, and having forewarned him, I asked the question, and he said, "I can only say the captain of the boat must have either been stupid or drunk." And that was that. So that was that. And another Gough story, if you don't mind me intruding.
Please. Please.
We went to, in Germany, some of the lads saw a sex shop and went in there because we were flying from Germany back to Australia, and they wanted to get Gough a present. So they got him a sock. It was a long sock with two round things. And we got on the plane, and Dooley made the presentation to him of this sock, and he looked at us. And he said, "I never thought you fellas thought I was such a big prick." I had quite a love-hate relationship with Gough. I'd become pretty disillusioned, and then started to discover that things were going funny. The part of the things that had happened on that trip were someone, I'm not sure if it was Hewitt, or someone else, I think it was Hewitt, had gone to see Kemlani about the foreign loans. So that's when the foreign loans affair actually began.
So where were you when this happened?
I was political correspondent for the Australian, special political correspondent for the Australian.
Oh, in London. So you're back here now.
Well, it started to break. Yeah, it started to break when I was back here. Some time after, but I pieced it together later because I had a particular job to do about it. But anyway, I'd become that disillusioned, and then I, as I said, I was also quite interested in what was going on in the Senate, and I got to know Reg Withers, who was then the leader of the government in the Senate, quite well, and his staff. And Reg and I got on quite well, and one day he decided he needed a new, pardon me, a new press secretary. So he asked me whether I'd be interested in the job, and I said, "You don't know what my politics are." And he said, "Well, I really don't care what your politics are." He said, "So long as you're not a card-carrying con, in which case you'd be committed to my distraction." But he said, "Other than that, I don't care how you vote. The only thing I want you to do is do your job for me honestly and loyally." And I thought to myself, that's a pretty decent sort of offer, and so I'll try that for a while. And so I left the Oz and started off with Reg. I started off with Reg the day before before they deposed Billy Snedden. And that had been building up for about, in fact, I think it actually started building up between the time I resigned and started work with Withers. And so I thought, you know, God, what have I got myself into here? And then Fraser became leader of the opposition. And I'd got on reasonably well with Fraser beforehand. He'd been Minister for Education, and I'd interviewed him a few times about that. Robert Maher, who was our principal private secretary, Ridge's principal private secretary, senior private secretary, they're called, said, "Well, it's short back and sides party now." And Rob, who had a beard and moustache and long hair, went and shaved the beard and got his hair cut short. And I wouldn't say my loyalties changed so much, but obviously if you're working for the opposition, you become a little bit more acutely aware of the deficiencies of government, if there are any. And the economy was getting worse and worse, and it was becoming fairly obvious that something would have to be done. There's a lot of stories about November 11, most of which aren't quite right. Rob and I, Withers had written the scenario for November 11 in a letter to Snedden while Snedden was leader. After the first double dissolution. May have been before. I wasn't working for him then. But what happened was that after Labor got into power, the coalition retained numbers in the Senate. And rather like the current Senate, they were quite obstructive. The senators didn't like being obstructive, and there was a strong division of opinion between the majority of members in the House of Reps, who felt that they should use their Senate numbers to block anything the government put up that they didn't like. And the view of the senators, which was that basically, this, whether we like it or not, this government's been elected, it's got a mandate to do certain things, and all we do is expose ourselves to criticism if we use our numbers to block those things. So there's an interesting attitude. And Reg finally wrote to Snedden saying, we have to be a lot more pragmatic about what we do in the Senate, and we should only block that legislation which would either be impossible for us to reverse if we got into government, or which threatens our capacity to get back into government, or which is so objectionable that the community would want us to throw it out. And I think from memory, if my timing is right, I think Snedden probably, if he didn't ignore that, he wasn't able to act on it. That's right, it did go to Snedden. Because one of the first things that happened after the change of leader was Fraser was asked to re-endorse that position, which in effect he did, although he chose not to have it included in the minutes of the Shadow Cabinet. But he did, I think, write a letter to Ridge saying that he agreed with that. So the opposition actually became less obstructionist for a period than it seemed. However, it also coincided with the time when Labor was putting through some very, very contentious legislation. The most important of which actually was the Electoral Amendment Bill. The Electoral Amendment Bills provided for several things, but one of the most important, apart from the affected redistributions, but there was also a provision that allowed for senators for the ACT and Northern Territory, expanded the number of senators from one to two, from memory, which became very, very important as events moved on. Because we were nearing a point where there was like to be a half Senate election. Well, there could be a half Senate election. And at a half Senate election, the senators from... No, that's right, the change was that the senators from the ACT and the Northern Territory would take their seats immediately after the poll was held, rather than from July 1 of the following year. And if that occurred, if there was a half Senate election and Labor won it, or even if Labor didn't win it, those two senators, if it could get the numbers in the territories, it could temporarily have a majority in the upper house, which would allow it to pass the electoral amendment bills, which were in effect going to give, they were separate from the senators, but they would have given they would have effectively given a gerrymander, which would have almost certainly ensured Labor would have won an ensuing election. That was never really made public, but that was one of the main issues we were concerned about. Coming back to Ridge's original letter, original scenario, it was that if the Senate did wish to force an election, it should hold, it should do it on money bills, but it should not reject the appropriation or supply bills, but hold them in the Senate, where, because if the bills were rejected, it was then the province of the Prime Minister in the lower house to determine whether to restore them and send them up to the Senate again. If they were held in the upper house, and if the therefore the motion was that the bills be deferred till a later date, if they were held there, a simple majority in the upper house could restore the bills for a vote. And if you had numbers, a simple majority would get the legislation through. And what that meant, when taken to its final conclusion, was that whoever controlled the numbers in the Senate, the leader of the party which controlled the numbers in the Senate, would be the only person who could guarantee the Governor General that his money bills would be passed. So we never rejected supply. We held supply. And the scenario was further refined in around about July, August, maybe August, September. I'm not sure of the date, but they were painting the Senate whip, or the Senate officers, and our office was closed down. And I remember Rob Maher and I were sitting down in the whip's office one afternoon, where we worked through all the dates on which things would have to take place, and worked out that at a certain date, around about by early December, if the appropriation bills had not passed, the government would be in a very difficult situation in terms of paying and meeting the ordinary annual services of government bills. And a Senate election, which would take whatever period of time it would take to go through the machinery, could not be held in time to guarantee that the money wouldn't have run out. And obviously they didn't do that work on the other side. So when the budget was introduced, we had a delegation of senators came into Ridge's room, in effect demanding that we reject the appropriation bills, because they thought they were dreadful. It was Hayden's first budget, I think. Anyway, they dithered and dathered, and finally the opposition did decide that it would defer passage of the bills on the condition that... By this time, Kim Larney had been blowing up and was becoming monstrous. Cairns had been sacked. Connor had been sacked. Gough and Cameron were fighting, and I think Cameron may have even been sacked. So the government was pretty well falling apart. Fraser was very reluctant to commit to it, because I think he was always concerned about the propriety of how he came into office. But with the exception of one or two, the shadow ministry was pretty well determined to go ahead with it. And I remember writing Richard's speech saying why we're knocking the why we're going to defer the appropriation bills. And the motions were, as I recall it, that the bills should be deferred until such time as the government agrees to submit itself to the people at an election. And that was continually done. And that was done not gratuitously. That was done because the journals of the Senate were theoretically the only official communication between the Parliament and the Governor-General. So we were... That motion was, in effect, an open letter to the Governor-General saying that you're not going to get your money until such time as you, as the government, agrees to go to an election. And without saying it, there was the implicit suggestion that if the Governor-General proceeded to force an election, he'd get his money. So Senate bills went backwards and forwards, and we just always kept holding them in the House. And people couldn't understand why we weren't going to outright reject them. And one day, Richard Carlton from the ABC and Peter Bowers from the Sydney Morning Herald both came in at separate times, and they said, you guys are going to lose this. And I said, no. I said, they said that the Governor-General won't step in. And I said, well, you want to have a look at the Constitution and just see, because the key clauses are that in relation to the Federal Executive Council, in effect, Governor-General's got to act on the advice of the Executive Council. The Executive Council is comprised of ministers, or members of the Executive Council are ministers of state for the Commonwealth, and the Executive Council or Executive Councillors hold office at the pleasure of the Governor-General. And I said, the Governor-General has in effect got the power to sack the Prime Minister. Oh no, he wouldn't do that. I said, okay. Not knowing that I'd probably given them, just speculating, I'd probably given them the best story that they could ever have had. And they didn't believe it, and I thought after a while, well, you know, I don't think I should really be pushing this idea too hard. And so then we got to the 11th. By the time we'd got to the 11th, the government was really getting desperate in terms of its financial position, and there was talk about forcing the banks to give it loans and things like that. Gough called Fraser, Doug Anthony and Phil Lynch to his office early in the morning and told them that he had decided to go to a half Senate election. And that message got passed back to us, and so we effectively said, well, that's it. And the view in the office was that we'd effectively lost this long drawn out battle of wills, and there would be a half Senate election, and if the half Senate election was held, and I think at that stage John Gorton had let it be known that he would be running for the seat of Canberra as an independent, and Gorton would probably get up in the ACT and he would vote for the passage of all the nasty legislation we didn't want, and we'd in effect not only lost the battle but lost the war. And so Ridge went off to the War Memorial for the 11 a.m. ceremony, and then came back, and we all agreed that we'd go to have lunch in our separate ways. And sometime between 11 o'clock and later, Ridge discovered what had happened. And I don't know that this day whether he found out beforehand or afterwards. I think it was after. I went to lunch with Jeff Kidney of the Perth Daily News over at the lobby. And sitting next to us was Kip Enderby and a couple of other people. And of course, everyone sort of thought the whole battle had been fought to the end, and so there was a fair bit of celebration going on over at the lobby. And all of a sudden the phone rang, and Kip was summoned over to, of course there were no mobile phones in those days, there was only a phone on the wall near the entrance to the kitchen. Kip went over there, came back, and his face was white. He was on the side of me, so I could see him. He excused himself from the table and said something very important has just come up. And he went rushing back over here, over to Parliament House. And Kitney and I had just about finished lunch, so we had a port to finish it off properly, and strolled back to Parliament House. I walked down the corridor leading towards the, or on the side of the Senate, and the two Senate clerks, or assistant clerks, Keith Bradshaw and Alan Cumming Tom, were wandering down the opposite direction. They had been very, very helpful to us, in fact, in framing all the motions and all the rules and things in the Senate. All the ritual in the Senate was being the clerks were actively assisting the opposition in putting that together. And they said as I walked past them, he's smiling, he knows what's going on. And I said, I'm smiling because I've had too much port, I don't have a clue what's going on. And I walked down to our office and it was deserted and all the phones were ringing like mad. And but there was a tie line between Malcolm Fraser's office and Ridge's desk, and that was ringing, so I thought, that's the most important one, I'd better pick that up. Picked up the phone, and Malcolm said, where's Ridge? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, you get down here. Who is it? And I told him. He said, well, get down here quick. So I got down to his office, and it was just absolute pandemonium. There were senators and members milling around it. There were, on the fringe of it, there were journalists and cameras and everything. And Malcolm saw me and he grabbed me over and dragged me into his office. And he said, go and find Rich. For God's sake, find Rich quick. Tell him that the opposition's going to move a censure motion and I want him to get me that, my bills as fast as he can. I said, what? He said, tell him the opposition's going to move a motion against me. I'm the Prime Minister and we've got to get those bills. And I said again, what? You're the Prime Minister? He said, I'm the friggin' Prime Minister. And so I said, yeah, okay. And I was like a little boy who'd been sent to go and do the shopping for Mum, you know, wandering back to the Senate, repeating to myself, he's the opposition's going to move a censure motion and he's the Prime Minister. Get me the bills. So no one's still in their office, so I went back through the door into the Senate, and Ridge is standing down in the horseshoe area where the ministers and leaders. And I walked over to him and I said, look, I don't know what's going on, but I've just been down to see Malcolm Fraser. And he's asked me to tell you that there's a censure motion against... that the opposition's moving a censure motion against him, and he wants you to get him the bills as fast as you can. And Reg said, Dad's all right, don't worry about that, I'll do that. He said, just tell, go and find the whip. And between you, tell all the fellas to just do whatever I say. I don't have time to explain,